This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 0500 GMT on Thursday, the 25th of September, these are our main stories. A bullet engraved with the words anti-ICE is found at the scene of a deadly shooting at an immigration centre in Dallas, Texas. Syria's first head of state to speak at the UN General Assembly for nearly 60 years calls for all sanctions on his country to be lifted. China commits to reducing its greenhouse gas emissions by up to 10%. Also in this podcast,
depending on the time that we launch, depending on the illumination, we could see parts of the moon that never have had human eyes lay upon them before. And believe it or not, human eyes are one of the best scientific instruments that we have.
We meet the astronauts who could slingshot around the moon as early as next February. An investigation is ongoing in Texas after a deadly shooting at a Center of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. That's the agency chiefly responsible for carrying out President Trump's pledge to expel millions of undocumented migrants. One detainee was killed and two others critically injured. The gunman is reported to have died from a self-inflicted wound. The FBI director, Kash Patel, posted an image of unspent bullets from the scene with the phrase anti-ICE written on one of them. The Republican senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, said the shooting was the latest example of violence aimed at ICE and CBP, or Customs and Border Protection.
This is the third shooting in Texas directed at ICE or CBP. This must stop. To every politician who is using rhetoric demonizing ICE and demonizing CBP, stop. To every politician demanding that ICE agents be doxxed and calling for people to go after their families, stop. This has very real consequences.
Later, Donald Trump took to his Truth Social platform to accuse what he called the radical left of inciting violence against immigration officers. He also said he'll be signing an executive order to dismantle what he called domestic terrorism networks. We heard more from our North America correspondent, David Willis.
It took place, Alex, at an immigration field office in Dallas. That's where detainees were being processed before being transported to a detention facility. And officials say the gunman started firing indiscriminately from a nearby rooftop, both at the building and at a van that was parked inside a secure entryway. They say that bullet casings bearing anti-government messages were found at the scene of this incident, and they believe the gunman was targeting members of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE. Presence of ICE agents, they're normally heavily armed, wearing masks and so on, in various parts of this country, has drawn quite a lot of criticism. Yet, despite that assertion, no ICE officials were hurt or killed in this attack. Instead, three migrants were struck by bullets, and one of them subsequently died. And of the other two who were injured, one who is said to be of Mexican descent is now in a critical condition in hospital. The gunman has been identified, Alex, as 29-year-old Joshua Juan, but officials have yet to reveal a motive for this attack.
And yet President Trump talked about deranged radical leftists.
That's right. And of course, there's been a rise in political violence in this country. And we've seen a lot of finger pointing, if you like, particularly since the murder of Charlie Kirk, the conservative activist, 2 weeks ago. President Trump really leading the way. He blamed Mr. Kirk's death on radical left wingers, as he put it. He vowed to clamp down on groups made up of such individuals. And he actually intends to sign an executive order later this week, which is aimed at dismantling what he calls left-wing domestic terrorism networks, which he says basically are inciting violence against conservatives, although he's yet to provide any evidence that left-wing groups pose more of a threat, a violent threat, than groups on the right. I mentioned we've yet to learn the motive for today's attack, but that didn't stop Mr. Trump and members of his cabinet from politicising this shooting, which, as Ted Cruz mentioned, is the third shooting directed at members of ICE in Texas alone over recent weeks.
David Willis. Syria's interim president has made his debut on the international stage in New York. Ahmed al-Sharaa is the first Syrian leader to address the UN General Assembly for nearly six decades. The former head of the Islamist al-Nusra Front toppled the dictator Bashar al-Assad in a lightning offensive at the end of last year, bringing to an end the civil war that started in 2011. Our senior international correspondent Orla Guerin reports from the Syrian capital, Damascus.
This was a moment of history for Syria, its return to the international stage. Ahmed al-Sharaa said Syria was reclaiming its rightful place among the nations of the world. He called for the complete lifting of sanctions, which he said shackled the Syrian people. The rebel commander turned interim president, a former member of al-Qaeda, looked at ease at the podium in a dark suit, until last December, when he led the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad. He had a $10 million bounty on his head. His speech was broadcast live in the main square in Damascus, accompanied by fireworks in the night sky. Ahmed al-Sharaa said his country had transformed from exporting crisis to providing an opportunity for regional peace. But he said continuing Israeli strikes against Syria were creating new dangers. He said Syrians stand firmly with the people of Gaza because they are deeply aware of the horrors of war. He told the UN the Assad regime had killed around a million innocent people and used chemical weapons and the worst kind of torture against its own citizens. He promised those responsible for sectarian violence in Syria would be held to account and said the country was now writing a new chapter of peace, prosperity and development.
Orla Guerin. Well, a few days earlier, on the sidelines of the gathering in New York, President al-Sharaa appeared on stage with retired General David Petraeus, a perhaps unusual pairing as the former CIA director was commander of US forces in Iraq when they imprisoned Mr. al-Sharaa for his role in fighting the invasion. General Petraeus told the BBC about how big a moment this speech was.
It's hugely significant. There's a personal angle to this as well, because as is well known, he was in detention in Iraq. But obviously, he has traveled quite a path since then, built the force that was able to topple the Bashar al-Assad regime, and now is, of course, the interim president, if you will, of the country, and trying to pull together a country that has just about all of the ethnic, sectarian, tribal, and political fault lines of the Middle East.
What sort of path have you had to travel to go from someone who essentially put him in prison to sitting down with him, as you did the other day, and having a civil conversation? And I think you have said you are a fan of his.
Well, I am a fan of what he's trying to do, certainly, and what he has done. And I should also note that I had not just the time with him on stage in the interview, but a time before that in the green room, and then an hour before that, which is a business council of many Syrian American business leaders. And he has a surprising mastery of the economic situation there with considerable detail. And I hope that in addition to lifting the sanctions that President Trump has already lifted, that Congress of the U.S. will follow through as well, and that they will lift the sanctions that they imposed, of course, on the Assad regime. But those right now prevent, for example, investing in construction, energy, and the financial sector, the three of which are probably the most important in helping the Syrian economy recover.
You know, though, that there are some in Congress who still view him as a jihadist, have not been on the journey that you have been on to recognize what you think is the journey he has been on. Are you trying to persuade them otherwise? Do you think Congress will come round to that way of thinking?
I do. Look, we deal with people that have traveled considerable paths all around the world, including a number in the Middle East. And he is certainly saying all the right things. I asked some very tough questions of him about how he is going to ensure not just majority rule, but what about all of the, again, ethnic, sectarian, tribal minorities? Will they have their rights honored? And there have been some troubling incidents.
Well, quite. Troubling incidents, thousands killed.
Yes.
And the UN and human rights groups have said that his security forces were participating in that. And that is the reason that some people are very skeptical.
Yeah, no, I raised this with him. I lay that out. His answers were very encouraging, frankly. But it's not words, as always, it's deeds. And I do think it's in our interest, our national interest, to do everything we can to enable him to succeed, at least until he proves that he does not any longer warrant our support.
General David Petraeus speaking to James Kumarasamy. On Tuesday, President Trump told the UN climate change was a con job. On Wednesday, the Chinese President Xi Jinping told the UN his country was setting its first ever concrete target to cut carbon emissions. His words are spoken by a translator.
China will, by 2035... reduce economy-wide net greenhouse gas emissions by 7% to 10% from peak levels, striving to do better.
Mr. Xi also indirectly took a swipe at the US, saying green transformation is the trend of our times, despite, as he put it, some countries going against that trend. But China is currently the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. And our environment correspondent Matt McGrath told us some people were hoping for more ambitious targets.
President Trump came to the UN on Tuesday and gave climate change a battering and basically said every country in the world was doing the wrong things on renewable energy. And there's been a lot of pushback on climate change this year or all around the world. So there's been a lot of hopes pinned on China, the world's biggest emitter of carbon dioxide, to come to bat basically and put a new plan on the table, as all countries are required to do this year, that would really move the dial in terms of keeping temperatures down, would move the world away from fossil fuels. So to see a target of 7 to 10% is a bit disappointing, I think, for many, many people. But to keep it in context, as I said, China is the world's biggest emitter. In 2023, it emitted 14 billion tons of carbon dioxide. 10% of that is 1.4 billion tons, and that's four times the UK's annual emissions of carbon. So it is a very significant amount of carbon. But I think people feel that this might have been a missed opportunity, given the fact that the US and others are a little bit in retreat on climate change.
Yes, President Xi implicitly criticised the US for retreating on climate change. But what has China been doing up until now before announcing this target?
China has been doing a vast amount in terms of renewable energy and in planting lots of trees. And it's the renewables that give real hope here. In 2020, they promised that they would install 1,200 gigawatts, which is a lot, of wind and solar by 2030. And they achieved that last year. So they're 6 years ahead of schedule on the installation of renewables. In this new plan, they're going to double that again, if you like, and get to 3,600 gigawatts by 2035. Most people think they will easily do that. And what's really interesting and what people are picking up on and holding on to as a sense of hope here is that President Xi clearly spoke about wind, solar and electric cars as being at the heart of their efforts to decarbonize and move their economy away. And they are doing that more than anybody else in the world right now, and they are doing it faster than everybody else. So while the headline target may be less than people expected, I think there's a lot of hope that they will overachieve, particularly on the renewables as they've done to date, and that that will actually drive down emissions far more than 10% in the long term.
Matt McGrath speaking to Janat Jalil. It's nearly 50 years since the last manned mission to the moon, so when NASA announced on Tuesday it would be sending a team on a flight around it as early as February of next year, the world took notice. The four astronauts have told a press conference they're ready for every scenario they could face during their 10-day mission to deep space and back. The Artemis crew, three Americans and one Canadian, also announced that they'd named their spacecraft Integrity. Our science editor Rebecca Morell has the details.
The four astronauts have been in training for their moon mission for the last 2 years. They'll be the first people to travel in the Orion spacecraft, now known as Integrity. The mission's pilot, Victor Glover, said a key moment would be the 45 minutes that they'll be out of contact as they pass around the far side of the moon. Mission specialist Christina Cook said this would be an opportunity to study the lunar surface.
We get to take 3 full hours and devote it to nothing other than observing the lunar surface. And depending on the time that we launch, depending on the illumination of the far side of the moon, we hope it's not the dark side. We hope it's the lit far side, because that could mean that we could see parts of the moon that never have had human eyes lay upon them before. And believe it or not, human eyes are one of the best scientific instruments that we have.
The spacecraft will have enough food, water and oxygen on board for the 10-day journey, as well as a specially designed toilet to overcome the challenges of going to the loo while weightless. But the conditions will be cramped. The spacecraft is about the size of a minivan. And for Canadian Jeremy Hansen, it will be his first time in space.
I do think it is going to be a bit of an adjustment for us when we get up there. We're going to constantly be in each other's way. These three are going to have to mentor me a little bit as I get my space legs, because they've all had 6-ish months on space station, and I'll be learning how to float and fly and bumping into stuff, and I'll need a little help probably.
Artemis commander Reid Wiseman said the crew were working well as a team and they were ready to get the job done on what he described as a magical mission.
Rebecca Morell. Still to come on this edition of the Global News Podcast.
They're going to get some sort of linen artefact, which is the same extent as the Tapestry 70 metres. They're going to put it into some sort of vibration damping case, and they're going to drive it to the UK from there. Then they will be able to say whether it's viable.
Could a trial run allay concerns about transporting the 1,000-year-old Bayeux Tapestry? Donald Trump has been strongly criticised by his Colombian counterpart Gustavo Petro over lethal airstrikes carried out by the US on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean. Speaking to the BBC in New York, Mr. Petro accused Mr. Trump of an act of tyranny. At least 14 people are known to have been killed. UN experts have described it as extrajudicial execution. Here's what the Colombian president told our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman.
We have a long history of collaborating with American agencies and other agencies of carrying out maritime seizures of cocaine. No one has ever died before. There is no need to kill anyone. And it is not necessary because, just like one might do with streets, you block the speedboat with larger boats. We have larger boats. And in recent years, we have been able to carry out operations with no deaths. Why launch a missile if you could simply stop the boat and arrest the crew? That's what one would call murder.
So how would you characterize President Trump's behavior and his decision to militarize this activity in the region of your country and using military force against boats like this?
Launching missiles over sovereign waters outside the United States is an act of tyranny. And what is happening there is a tyranny. We cannot know if these young people were migrants or if they were working for drug trafficking mafias. And in both situations, they have no right. Mr. Trump has no right to launch a missile against them.
Yo dije que si se confirma en el caso colombiano,
if we are able to confirm that among these young people, we don't know yet, but if there are Colombians, we have the obligation. The Colombian justice system must open a criminal investigation for murder. And it would be the officials responsible for these murders that would be prosecuted. Which government officials from the United States allowed the murder of these young people by launching a missile at this speedboat, independent of what they were transporting, because right there they broke international law.
The Colombian President Gustavo Petro speaking to our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman. Is the dream of home ownership slipping out of reach for many Americans? Prices are climbing, supply can't keep up with demand, and high interest rates are keeping sellers on the sidelines. Tariffs and rising construction costs are squeezing builders too, piling more pressure on families and the economy, as Monica Miller explains.
Robert McKenna is settling into his new home in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Come here.
He now has time to enjoy his new backyard and play fetch with Kia, a 5-year-old golden doodle.
This was important when we were getting the house, to have a backyard so she could do this. Hey.
He and his wife Megan say they are happy the house hunting process is finally over.
So, I mean, we would look at maybe 15 homes sometimes on a Saturday or Sunday. Like, literally, we'd leave our house at like 9 a.m., get home by like 6 p.m., eat, and want to just sleep.
For generations, home ownership in the U.S. has been a path to stability and wealth. But today, many Americans say the dream feels out of reach. The couple looked at dozens of homes and lost 8 bidding wars before finally landing a house. Even with solid jobs in healthcare and finance, the couple say the process left them drained.
I finally get to a number that I'm happy with. I can see myself living in it. And then you get the news, hey, guess what? You didn't get this one.
Across the country, high prices, scarce supply, and historically high mortgage rates are keeping many potential homebuyers locked out. Some homeowners who paid off their properties or refinanced during the pandemic are reluctant to sell, while younger buyers are struggling to compete. Real estate agents like Diane Loomis say speed is everything.
You don't have the time to process here. Stay up all night because, you know, I'd like to think about it. Start thinking because it may not be there tomorrow.
So this will be 4 bedrooms. I think there's actually...
Home buyers and real estate agents aren't the only people impacted by the shifts in the market. Andrew Kay is a real estate developer in New Jersey.
With material shortages that came out of COVID and now tariffs being in place, it's an extremely uncertain industry.
Real estate developers often face a patchwork of zoning laws, permitting delays, and local opposition that slow or block new construction. Andrew says codes and regulations were once more lenient.
I am all about both smart growth and smart planning and smart construction. There were mistakes, as I said, made in the 70s and 80s with regard to land planning and stormwater and things that were not accounted for. And now, as I said, I think we've just gone too far in the other direction, mostly out of fear of, oh no, what if that happens again?
Washington lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are alarmed. Republicans and Democrats don't agree on much these days, but a bipartisan bill is making its way through Congress.
Someone should say praise the Lord. That's a miracle like Peter walking on the water.
Speaking at an event in Washington, the bill's co-sponsor, Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, says it aims to expand affordable housing, reduce regulatory barriers, and improve oversight of federal housing initiatives.
Solving this problem has got to be paramount for decision makers all across the spectrum of government and, frankly, in the private sector as well. So I look at this through the eyes of a kid who wanted a front yard to play in and not just a concrete driveway.
First-time home buyers Megan and Robert McKenna finally got their foot on the property ladder. They say achieving the American dream is a lot of work these days.
It's an exhausting dream. It's a hard dream to obtain.
Home ownership remains a cornerstone of the American dream. The Fed's rate cuts could help more buyers chase it, even if the cost of that dream has never been higher.
Monica Miller. And you can hear more of Monica's report by searching for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts. 23 miners who were trapped in a mine in the northwest of Colombia for 48 hours have now been rescued. Clitzia Sala has this report.
Come on, guys, you can do it, say colleagues and family members as the 23 miners emerge one by one from the collapsed shaft of Colombia's La Reliquia mine, covered in mud but alive. Social media footage shows family members welcoming them with hugs and tears. The group had been trapped underground since Monday, receiving food and water through a water extraction hose. This time, one of the many mining accidents that occur in Colombia every year has a happy ending. In light of the many deadly incidents in the sector, the National Mining Agency has expressed its commitment to worker safety and training.
Clitzia Sala. Now, how do you move a nearly 1,000-year-old prized artwork from one country to another without damaging it? That's the challenge facing the authorities in France, which is loaning its world-famous Bayeux tapestry to the British Museum next year. The 70-metre-long embroidery chronicles the Norman invasion of England in 1066. Many French cultural experts have warned that the priceless artefact is too fragile to be transported. So now a trial run has been arranged for officials to assess the risks. Historian Dr. David Musgrove has studied the tapestry extensively.
There's been a lot of concern raised in certain quarters in France about the fragility of the tapestry and whether it is tenable to move it without damaging it. So there's been a lot of work done on this over several years. The loan was initially announced back in 2018, so it's been like 7 years in the planning. They've had a chance to do lots of studies on it, and those studies have been published. They're technical, lots of interesting scientific details. But what they're doing now, so they are putting these plans into action, and in December there is supposed to be a dry run, a voyage à blanc, I understand, is the French term for it, where basically they are going to see what happens when they do a replica or a I'm not sure exactly what it is they're moving, because I'm not sure they've got a replica linen artefact. They've got a photographic record, which was once owned by Charlie Watts of Rolling Stones fame, but that's not on linen, so I don't think that would give it the sense. So they're going to get some sort of linen artefact, which is the same extent as the tapestry, 70 metres. They're going to put it into some sort of vibration damping case, and they're going to drive it to the Eurotunnel, and I assume across to the UK from there. And then they're going to study it, and then they're going to announce the results of that in January or February, and then they will be able to say whether it's viable to move it or whether they need to do further work on it.
Historian Dr. David Musgrove. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service. Use the hashtag GlobalNewsPod. This edition was produced by Stephen Jensen and Rebecca Wood. It was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.